해석해. So, how would you tell if left a number is broken? So, what people do, so the short answer is yes. And the way you do is with searching for double beta decay. Neutrinoless double beta decay, so it's zero new. So what's double beta decay? Double beta decay, ordinary double beta decay, so two neutrino, ordinary beta decay, you know, you got some nucleus, goes to another nucleus, plus an electron, and an antineutrino, let's say, or possibly a positron and a neutrino. And it does that because the, you know, in the grand scheme of energy levels, there's a this is n prime, it can release energy by doing that. Now it happens that there are some you know that if you plot the a beta decay changes a proton to a neutron, and so it doesn't change the sum of the protons and neutrons, it changes only the difference. And if you plot the energy, the binding energy of a, or the mass of a nucleus as a function of that difference, you know that you get a parabola, right? That the, it's basically it's a valley of stability. If you plot the, you know, if you plot the nuclides, if you plot, I guess, proton number against neutron number, and you say, ask, you know, which are the stable nuclei, you get this kind of, this big smeary thing here, right? Where there's unstable things off on the sides, and there's stable nuclei in the middle, and there's the odd place where there's nothing stable, and then it stops with the uranium. And the ones out here tend to beta decay in towards the center. And that's why they're unstable. And it's because the energy as a function of this variable transverse to the valley has a minimum. So there's an optimal proportion of neutrons to protons, which comes from, you know, if you have too many protons, then you're paying a price of Coulomb energy. And there's a symmetry energy that you like to have. That's not the right one, actually. I forget what the hell the other one was. It's been a million years since I learned nuclear physics. But there's a, you know, there's a, too many neutrons is bad, too many protons is bad. And so if you look at a slice through here like that, there are nuclei. That's too steep. You know, there are nuclei for specific values of numbers of protons and neutrons. And let me make sure I do this right here. I'm going to get burned if I get into too much detail here. There's a class of nuclei, and what I'm going to be vague about here is why this works. But there's a class of nuclei, so there exist nuclei for which the process of beta decay, they're off to the side of this valley, and beta decay is not allowed because the thing you would get by taking one neutron and making it into a proton, say, is actually more energetic than the thing you started off with. And that can happen, for instance, if there's magic numbers, there's places where you have, the thing I'm groping for is that, what I'm remembering this is happens when you have, there's an isotopic symmetry amongst the nuclear force, you know, isospin symmetry, honest to God isospin, the SU2 that rotates the up and down quarks, is a symmetry of the nucleons, and the protons and neutrons behave like a doublet under it. And in the absence of the Coulomb interaction and the things that break isospin invariance, the nuclear force is blind to protons and neutrons. But there's a a regime which I'm not quite reconstructing here, which is that if you have particularly low energy, if you arrange, if the neutrons and protons are at a magic number, so if you now change a neutron to a proton, you can actually screw up you can have an energy cost for that. And so because of that, the nucleus you would get that you'd like to decay into is actually more energetic, and so you don't get decays in that direction. But if you were able to do two beta decays in a row, you can skip that one to get to a nucleus which is, again, symmetric. It's the thing I'm groping towards is that there's an energy cost that there's an energy cost which likes there to be I'm not going to get it. Almost had it there, but it's there exist nuclei for which one decay is forbidden, two decays is allowed. So that if you like the, here's nucleus number one, here's nucleus number two, here's nucleus number three, and each of these differs by, if this has Z and N, this would be, say, Z plus one, N minus one, and this is Z plus two, N minus two, where this is neutron number and proton number. So you can't decay that way, but you can decay that way. That can happen. The reason it's important not to have a... So for these nuclei, what will happen is that they will decay. They'll be particularly long-lived because beta decay is already can be small. Double beta decay will be really, really, really small. But because the first decay is not allowed, you're not trying to see this decay in a background where this decay is happening all the time, and you'd have no chance at all of seeing it. But so there are a nuclei for which the only way it can decay is to jump and have two beta decays happen at the same time. So if you thought in terms of protons and neutrons, it's like if you imagine here's a proton that's made of protons, here's a nucleus made of protons and neutrons. You know, this one here does a beta decay, the W, and an electron, say, and a neutrino. And then this one here does the same thing. And this happens sufficiently close together that it's you don't have a appreciable regime where you have the intermediate state of just having one decay, because that's something which is a virtual state because it would actually cost you energy to get to it. So this is called two neutrino double beta decay. And it's been seen. You know, these nuclei do decay, and their lifetimes are very long, but they're measurable. And they tend to be things like 10 to the 21 years, things like that. So the half-life tends to be longer than the age of the universe by many factors. So the tau is much less than the age of the universe. But if you have a big enough sample, you see every once in a while somebody decays, and then you can measure that it's happened. Now so that's been seen. That's consistent with lepton number invariance. But what people are looking for is, one thing I should tell you is, of course, you don't see the neutrinos here. All you're really seeing in this kind of a decay is the electrons. And so one way this happens is, one of the isotopes for which this happens is germanium-76. And so germanium is actually a device, it's an element from which you can make semiconducting crystals, and so you can actually make detectors out of germanium. And so one of the best measurements of double beta decay comes about by taking a germanium crystal made with it's been enriched in this particular isotope which has this beta decay. And so when it beta decays, the electrons are actually producing tracks in the crystal, and the crystal itself is the detector. So it's a very good, very sensitive system for this kind of decay. And if you plot the energy of the two electrons summed together, so this is E electron 1 plus E electron 2. E electron 1 plus E electron 2. And you plot the number of decays, then what happens is you get some sort of a characteristic spectrum which does what beta decays typically do. You know, there's some maximum energy. And at this energy, the electrons have all the energy, and the neutrinos are coming off with the very minimum energy they could have done. But here, if the electrons come out with this much energy, the neutrinos are carrying off more energy than before. And so the existence of the spectrum is to do with the fact that you're not seeing some of the energy that's coming off of the decay. So that's been seen. They measure the shape. Now what they also look for is if lepton number were violated, so So if neutrino, if L, if neutrinos and antineutrinos were not distinguishable, so in the context of what we said this morning, that means that the lepton number is violated and there's a mass. If there was no mass, then the helicity would distinguish the neutrino from the antineutrino. Then if you could have this process happening, this one here, there's another process that could also happen. That would be have your nucleus emit these two decays. So they each emit their electron. And now the neutrino that's produced here, what we got here was, say, two electrons and two antineutrinos. So this would be an antineutrino. This would be an antineutrino, but if an antineutrino and a neutrino are actually indistinguishable, then this is actually a neutrino, and we can annihilate them against each other. So we just have a neutrino line like that, and that would mean, if this were true, this process was possible. And that would be a decay where the nucleus decays to another nucleus, and all that comes out is electrons, and there's no neutrinos coming out at all. So that's called zero neutrino double beta decay. And it has the property that, you know, if you ask for the spectrum of this decay as a function of the energies, there's going to be a probability for each electron to have different energies. But if you add those energies together, like I did here, then as far as the decay is concerned, the sum of these electron energies is like one particle. This is like a two-body decay. A nucleus went to another nucleus and a thing which has the sum of electron energies. And so that should have a monochromatic, the energy and momentum conservation would dictate for you what the energy of these electrons, the sum of the energy of the electrons is. So the spectrum of that kind of a decay would be a spike right here, where there's no neutrinos to carry anything off. So this is what you would expect for two neutrino double beta decay. And this is what you'd expect for zero neutrino double beta decay. So what people do is, since they see this decay, they look really, really carefully here to see if there's anything going on there. So is there a peak going on there? Because if there was, that would be the thing that would correspond to this happening every once in a while. And so some people look for that. And it turns out that if you actually evaluate this Feynman graph, what you had to do is, for this graph to be non-zero, you had to violate lepton numbers. So you had to have vertices here that tell you the lepton number is violated. But you also have to have a non-zero mast. And so that shows up in that if you look at the fermion number flow here, this whole answer, the propagator here would have been, you know, pi p slash plus m over p squared plus m squared for that neutrino. And the p slash term doesn't gives you something zero when you calculate the rate. So that's not contributing. And so you get a, for small masses, you get an amplitude which is proportional to the mass for small masses. How small is small? Small is compared to the typical momentum flowing through this line, and that momentum is basically comparable to the amount of energy that's available in this nucleus. You know, the nucleus is, you can think of it as being a big bag of nucleons, and they have a Fermi momentum, which is because there's a, you know, there's a Fermi system, so you multiply. It's like atoms that you're filling levels, and everybody's not in their ground state. So there's a Fermi degeneracy, and corresponding to a Fermi momentum, and the Fermi momentum in the nucleus is in the ballpark of, you know, 100 MeV or something like that. So a characteristic momentum flowing through this line is 100 MeV. So if the neutrino mass is much less than something like 100 MeV, then the amplitude for this thing is proportional to the neutrino mass times factors of energies and things. And so the rate is then proportional to the sum squared. And a measurement of the lifetime here, you can then translate into a measurement of it'll depend on neutrino mass, but it'll also, if these masses, if we have a vertex, so if our vertex, remember, now has the property that we have a lepton, gamma mu, gamma left neutrino, but there's a species of neutrino here, and so we have lepton A here, we have a matrix here, V I A. Actually, I guess the convention is the charged lepton goes first here, so it's the opposite convention for quarks. We have to sum over all possible species of neutrinos that's here. So the amplitude actually turns out to be, it's proportional to the sum over neutrino species of the neutrino mass times the mixing angle on both sides here. So there's a V A I E A J I. This is V E I V E I. Why does that bother me? That's right. No, that's good. So this is sometimes called, you know, M effective or M bar or some average value of the mass weighted by the mixing angles. You can think of it as being, it's also the EE element of the mass matrix. That's another way of thinking of that. If the mass of the neutrino happened to be large compared to 100 MeV, then the amplitude goes like 1 over a mass like you expect it to. And so that's something that's a limit you might think about if you imagine sterile neutrinos that are heavy running around. But for the most part, what's relevant is we know that there are three neutrinos that are light. And so this approximation is pretty good for, we think, for the three neutrinos that have been seen. We know it's good for, there are direct limits on the masses of neutrinos coming from things like beta decay and muon decay. And for most of those, I think for the tau neutrino, there's not a direct bound which is better than this, but for the other ones, I think it is better than that. Bottom line is you can treat, so this has never been seen, so that becomes an upper limit on how big these masses are, and the present upper limit is something like MEE is less than or of the order of an electron volt, something like that. So it's in that kind of a ballpark. It's a little bit uncertain because it depends, if you're comparing what you see to something like this, this function depends on the nuclear wave function a little bit. So there's a certain amount of slop there to do with nuclear physics, which can cost you factors of two or things. So it's there's a certain amount of uncertainty in this, but it's people will quote different numbers. They'll use different models of the nucleus to get a sense as to how sensitive you are to that. But it's this kind of a ballpark you're talking about. And this is interesting because you're going to see that there's good reason to believe that there's a neutrino whose mass is about a tenth of that, something like 0.015, depending on how you count, in that ballpark. So these people have had series of bounds on what this mass is, but they're within striking distance of something. They should actually get something non-zero if there's only three neutrinos around, and if neutrino oscillations are being described by mixing in the way that I'm about to talk about, and due to the existence of this matrix here, just through oscillations. You should also know that there's an experiment. This experiment actually that had this best limit. A subset of the experiment claims to have discovered neutrinos double beta decay. So they claim that they see a little peak here. And it's a German-Russian group. And the German part of it claimed to see something, and the Russian part of it left at that point. And it was their germanium, so they took the germanium and went home. And so now there's other experiments being done that are trying to corroborate or not, but I think people are fairly I think it's a fair statement that people are skeptical about whether or not there's really evidence for there to be a signal there or not. But But the signal they claim is in this ballpark, so it's you know, it's a 1 or 1.5 electron volts. Any questions about that? That's so. Well, yeah, what was Fermi and Flowness? It was a conservation of there was a conserved thing that the fermion carried. That's what the flow was measuring. Well, in all the other things, it could have been baryon number, or it could have been lepton number, or it could have been electric charge. For all the other fermions, they have electric charge, so you can always think of it as being electric charge. But if you had a spin a half particle, which is not distinct from its antiparticle, then there is no charge, because otherwise the charge would distinguish them. And so there is no concept for fermion number in that case. So it's just like for the, when we did Feynman graphs with W bosons in them, we had arrows in the W lines, right? Because then the electric charge distinguished the W from the W complex conjugate field. Whereas when we did the Z boson, there weren't any arrows. And so the, your freedom in how you connected up the graph was more constrained when you had the arrows, because you had to make the arrows match too. And that was because the thing that was created by W, thing that was destroyed by W was not the thing that was destroyed by W star. So you had to think of them as being distinguishable. But for the Z boson, any Z is equally good as any other. So that the thing that's created, the antiparticle being created, is can be destroyed by the field. And so there's no, you don't have to distinguish whether or not it's a W or W star that's destroying things. For fermions, until now, it's always been true that there was an electric charge running around. And so they were always like Ws. And so you had to keep track of that arrow to keep track of whether the field or the field bar was destroying the particle. But if you have neutrinos which are indistinguishable from antiparticles, then it's like a Z boson, and that they really, there's no arrow because the field and its complex conjugate both destroy the same thing. So it's so when you're doing the counting in this graph, there's a factors of two that you have to keep track of to do with the statistics, like we did for the real versus complex scalars. But it really is true you can't draw the arrows in this case. You can draw the charge, the electric charge flow here, right? Because there's electric charge flowing out here, but then the W carried it. And then it was went to the proton. So if you depend on exactly what you're following, the arrows are normally following some conserved thing. And so you have to kind of say what the conserved thing was. And up until now, it's been fermion number, because if you didn't have neutrino masses, you could think of it as being baryon number or lepton number, but fermion number was a conserved thing. But now it's no longer conserved. That's all I want to say about that. So what about oscillations? So you could tell, in principle, whether or not lepton number is broken, and the neutrinos are distinguishable from any neutrinos. And this is why this is such an interesting experiment. So it's been going for a long time. They've been looking for this. But it's worth doing the search, because it tells you something very basic about neutrinos if you see it, more than just the fact that they have mass. Because people now take for granted they have mass because you've seen oscillations. But this makes an important distinction amongst the kinds of masses you could have. And in particular, because we know that if we don't change the number of light particles, we have to have Majorana masses, finding that lepton number was conserved. If lepton number is conserved, what happens is that this sum is zero, because this is the element of the mass matrix in the flavor basis, the EE element. And these are the mass eigenstates, the actual eigenvalues. And if there's a lepton number which is conserved, this element is zero. And so when you diagonalize the matrix, you know, these V's are going to be such that the sum of the mass weighted by these mixing angles is going to always conspire to be zero. And it's not a miracle that it's conspiring to be zero, because there's a symmetry forcing it to be zero. And it's easiest to see that when you write it this way, when you can see that that's an element of the matrix which had to be zero if there was a conserved charge in the problem. So if they get the bound below, you know, the mass of the heaviest neutrino that you get from solar neutrino measurements, then that tells you that at least some of the masses have a conserved lepton number. And that tells you that there's at least four neutrinos going on at low energies, and there's not just three. Because there's no way you can have a conserved lepton number with only the three neutrinos we know about. Right. So my money is that they're going to find this, because the conservative thing is you just have the neutrinos we see, any sterile neutrinos or anything that's breaking lepton number is very heavy. And that's the easiest description of everything we see, and it's very plausible theoretically. So this conservative money is that they're going to measure this once it gets down to the limits the heaviest mass that you don't have to be there. So what the final solution is. So again, if we go to unitary gauge, and we take the Higgs to be 0V, the new term, our Lagrangian, is basically the standard model plus a neutrino mass term. So it's, you know, MAB, U bar A, gamma left, UV, plus complex conjugate. And this M, depending on where you got it from, would be our coefficient, you know, GAB divided by M times V squared, let's say, or in the case of the explicit model of the seesaw mechanism, this was, you know, YAI M inverse IJ YBJ times V squared. So, you know, so your favorite thing will make this whatever you like, but it's always giving you a term like this as far as the neutrinos are concerned. So it's the usual story. So if we want to diagonalize, we can always diagonalize neutrino masses. And we do that by taking the left-handed neutrinos and we multiply them by some matrix, you know, UAB, unitary matrix. So the right-handed pieces will do the complex conjugate of this. And so now the story is very much like it was for the quarks, because we had already, you know, we'd already gone through and asked the charged leptons to do a similar thing. We'd done some sort of a, say, WAB. And we had the right-handed ones, we did the same way. But now what's happening is just like for the quarks, as long as these are unitary, so U dagger U is one. That requirement is coming about because we don't want to screw up the kinetic terms. The kinetic terms were nu bar d slash nu, and we don't want to ruin that. And that tells us that this U has to be a unitary matrix. Same thing for W. We want to preserve nu bar a d slash nu a. But what happens, because it's unitary, that also means that the Z boson coupled to, you know, Z mu, nu bar A, gamma mu, and G vector, the G axial, gamma 5, nu A. That was before we diagonalized the masses. So when we diagonalize the masses, we're going to get factors of this U matrix here. But because of this gamma matrix, we're going to get U dagger U. And so because of this property in the mass basis, we're not going to get any new mixing angles here, just like we did for the quarks. And that's important. That was very important for the quarks because we didn't want to have a process where we had the option of having a Z boson turning into, say, a strange quark and a down quark. That shouldn't be possible to happen, and you might have worried that it could have happened when we did a create definitions like this for the quarks. If this were to happen, that would allow things like kaons, which are S bar Ds, could decay through a Z boson into things like you know, mu plus mu minus. And that's not seen to happen. The branching ratio for that is extremely small. And so it's a good thing about the standard model that it does this. That's, again, the Jim mechanism we talked about before. So the same kind of thing is happening to the leptons here. You're not seeing any processes like Z is not going to ever go to, you know, E plus mu minus. There's good limits on that happening. There's lots of Zs that were produced at lept. They've decayed into things, and you never see this happening. So there's good bounds on that. And so this is a good thing, that we're not getting anything which is mixing different flavors of leptons with each other. What I talked about there would be the lepton-lepton version of what I'm talking about for neutrinos. You have less information about the neutrino-neutrino one, of course. So, for the charge current couplings, it's the same story as for the quarks. So, if we have a W, we're storing a negative W, we want to create a negative lepton. We on A, neutrino B, times matrix V. And this matrix V is the product of U with W, because we rotate this thing by something, we rotate this thing by something. So V is, I guess, going to be W dagger U. So that implies that V is, again, unitary, because these are both unitary. But it's because the leptons, the thing we needed to diagonalize the electron mass, the charged lepton masses, need not be the thing that we need to diagonalize the neutrino masses. That's what's allowing the possibility of a mismatch between these rotations, and that's what's giving us the potential of having a off-diagonal vertex here. So the message is that we can pair any neutrino with any charged lepton in a W interaction, unlike what we had before. So we should just think about L processes. We have a process where a reaction produces an electron and a neutrino, nu I. We'll do that with some amplitude, you know, V. If we're going to produce electron, that means we're going to get a V, you know, E, I, here. And over here, if we produce it, we see it, we detect this thing by a process involving, say, a mu plus is produced, let's say, stuff. So there's stuff came in, stuff comes out that I'm not caring about. This will involve a V, and a mu, I, complex conjugate. And so whatever the amplitude is for this thing, for seeing the electron, seeing lepton A here, at creation, together with seeing lepton B at detection, that's going to be a sum over the amplitude for any given I. So that would be, you know, V E I B star, or say A I. Some function of in the mass of the neutrino I and other things. Now, if you actually put this neutrino very close to being on shell, so there would, in principle, there would be a propagator, you know, p slash I p slash plus m over p squared plus m squared. But if you really have a large separation between these two points, then you're requiring, you know, the farther apart you make these things, the more you're forcing the particle to live right on the mass shell, and you're picking off you're forcing that yourself to be living at the pole of that propagator. Sorry? I didn't hear that. That's not just for neutrinos, that's always true, that if you I didn't actually do this in detail except for when we did the Z boson. But it's always true. Remember when we did the Z boson? Whenever you have a particle, if you think about it, you know, you do some scattering process where you have a particle and you do something with it, and then there's a final state particle, and you treat the initial particle and the final state particle as being asymptotic states, so there's something which you've given to you. But really, they were produced in some other thing, right? So if you did scattering of, if you did muon scattering from something, the muon actually came to you from a pion decay. That's how you made it at the beam. And so almost everything you do, you know, including photons, you know, if you, they came from somewhere there, the light was emitted somewhere, and then you used it, and then you did something else with it. So it's really true that it's always, you should always think of any process you're interested in. If you had a, you thought you were doing a scattering of two particles to get some final particles. These things are really producing some earlier thing. You're detecting these things and some other thing which will do something else. And it's kind of an ideal, it's an idealization that you're just taking that process and calculating its rate. And you could ask, why does it work? And the reason it works is that if you calculate this whole thing, the physical limit where you actually produce something and then you let it propagate for a long time on its own before the decay happens or the interaction happens corresponds in momentum space to living very, very close to the where the propagator had a pull. For reasons that I'll be more specific about in a second, but if you take my word for it, then if you remember what happened when we did Z decay, we first talked about Z's decaying into things, and then we later on did E plus E minus goes to Z goes to stuff. And here we got some sort of thing which depended on momentum. But in the limit that I actually sat on the resonance, the rate factorized into the rate for producing the Z, and then separately the rate for the Z to decay. So that you could, in this case, on resonance, the cross-section on resonance was basically for E plus E minus went to, say, fermion, fermion bar. That explicitly, I showed you, became the rate for E plus E minus goes to Z times the branching fraction for Z to go to FF bar. And it just dropped out. And the reason it dropped out was that we had for the Z, we had a propagator which was A to mu nu plus P mu P nu over M squared divided by P squared plus M squared. And when we were on the resonance, basically this was zero. We also had P plus I M gamma or something like that. But when this was zero, that's actually saying that the energy is equal to the square root of P squared plus M squared. And this thing, when this was true, was the same thing as the sum over spins of epsilon mu epsilon star nu of the Z that was produced. And so those two things together, when stuck into the full amplitude, showed you that the whole thing factorized into the product of the production process and the destruction process with the propagation in between being a sum over virtual things. So the thinking of this as being a real particle corresponds to sitting at the pole here, is what that example did. But that's a more general statement, and the more general statement comes about because I'm not sure if I can do this in my head, but it's this is in Weinberg's field theory book. There's a, I can't remember if he calls it this, but it's a poleology is what they call it. It's often phrased as the LSZ reduction formula in most field theory books. And it's the statement that if you give me a Green's function, you calculate some Green's function, so it's some time ordered product of a bunch of fields, you know, phi of x, phi of z. And in momentum space, so you're going to Fourier transform these things. So you'll have integral dx of e to the I dx of that. Then the LSC reduction formula says that there's a pole associated with each of these external momenta. And so there's a residue always in momentum space, 1 over p squared plus m squared for that thing. Some residue z, so this whole thing as a function of momentum has a due to the external lines has a factor like this, times a coefficient say a of p, and the basically the LSZ reduction says if you amplitude all the multiply by p squared plus m squared for all these things, and then cancel out this normalization factor z, then what's left is the S matrix for the process that you're interested in. And that's happening because if you thought of this thing as being, if you thought about the case where this process, so I've got how many lines, 6 lines there. If you thought of that process as being, when is it dominated by this process for something? If it was dominated by something where the particle, if there's a graph like this somewhere in the process, if I sit on the pole, you know, I know that this propagator has a pole because the propagators all have poles. And if I sit at that pole and I ask, in this Fourier transform, so there's two statements. One statement is that in momentum space, if I choose these initial momenta to sit so that this thing is on mass shell, this is going to win, because the pull will dominate all the other graphs which don't have the singularity in it. So that if I arrange the kinematics of these initial variables to be such that the momentum flowing through this line is on mass shell, which I can do because I can adjust their energies and their momenta, and the energy conservation is going to say that no matter what happens in here, this is the sum of those incoming energies and some of those momenta. So I can always vary them and choose them to sit on this pole. When I do that, this graph beats all the other graphs because of the pole. And then I can ask what this amplitude becomes in that limit. And it becomes basically, you know, it's something, becomes basically the story I told you over there, that this amplitude becomes the amplitude for producing this particle phi, let's say, to produce phi, times the amplitude for phi to go to the final state with a factor which is basically the pole, p squared plus m squared and some residue possibly. And so then the analog of this reduction theorem is actually doesn't rely on these things. These don't have to be elementary fields. You could take, you know, q bar q here for the quark field, and then this is something which has the quantum numbers of a meson. And then there will be, because, you know, we know that the Hamiltonian of QCD has an eigenstate which is a meson, there will be a process where this amplitude will have a, this Green's function will have a pole when the momentum along the if I insert a complete set of states here, you know, this is already a momentum space. So if I ask for the momentum that the Fourier transform of this X to be set as close to the mass shell of a meson, which has the quantum numbers to be produced by this thing from the vacuum, there will be a pole in the answer by an argument like this. And as long as I properly divide out by the amplitude for producing the meson from those quarks, which is this factor, and the pole, then what's left is the amplitude for this meson to do whatever the rest of the graph was. And it's just the, you know, the it's just the, it sounds deep, but all it is you're, it's just given that you know that propagators have poles, and if you tune yourself to sit at the pole, that graph wins, then you know that in the limit that you choose these external momenta to be living on the pole, the answer, the full answer is being dominated by this particular graph, and this particular graph just has these properties, that it's a factor, two factors, you know, there's a residue, which is these two factors divided by the pole. That's the statement that this thing is dominated by the pole. And if you ask what this remainder of the thing is, it's just this graph, and that's just what you would have calculated for the, if you're interested in the amplitude. If somebody walked in the room and said, what's the process where phi does this, you would have drawn that graph. So the statement is that if you kinematically sit so that this the external momenta and energies would be on mass shell for a particle that could be exchanged, then in the limit that you're actually right on that pole, and this thing is not the, and that thing is very is stable or very, very long lived, so that this term is not important. Then the pole wins, and so then the process is factorizing automatically. So there's a general statement that if you arrange things so that the thing that's being exchanged is on shell, then the description is exactly the same as if you thought that there was a production process, which you don't care about, at some amplitude that you are interested in. And then there's the amplitude for that thing that you produce to do whatever it does, and you can focus on that second part without figuring out what happened beforehand. So it's just to do with the statement I'm making is just a statement about you know, the momentum dependence of these amplitudes, the Green's functions, and how you get an S matrix from a Green's function. And what you do for a Green, you know, the only difference between a Green's function and an S matrix is that the external lines are on shell. And you make sure you normalize it properly. So that there's a general statement that Green's functions, these momenta didn't have to be on shell. They could use energy, momentum, could be anything because it's a Fourier transform variable. S matrix elements, these were physical energies and momenta, so they really were on shell. And there's a known connection between the two. And then if you now ask about correlations of other operators like this, then as long as you've got poles to sit on, those will win if you put yourself in the kinematic regime where you're making that denominator zero, and then the amplitude is automatically factorizing into pairs of things which have the interpretation of the production of that particle and the decay of that particle. And so then your conditional probabilities to do with what the probability, what the phi particle does after it's produced, don't care about the production probability. So then from then on you can ask questions just taking phi as an external state. You're saying in position dependent, in position space, what's the analog of being on a shell? In position space, what happens is well, in position space, the statement I wanted to make, if I didn't make it this way, was that if it's on shell, say it's massless or something. That means that if it's on shell, it's moving at the speed of light. So if I take production here and production there at some position in time, if I've adjusted the position to be such that I can get from here to here in the time available moving at the speed of light, then I'm going to be on shell in momentum space. So it's what you're asking there is that in position space, you're asking is that the time and the place of the two events were on the light cone if it's a massless particle, or it's on the mass, it's on the trajectory of a particle moving with that speed if it has a mass. And if that's the way you've set up the position space thing, then in momentum space that's going to translate into being on shell, and then this whole story goes through. So given that story, thanks for asking, what you can do is you can think of the propagation process. The only thing that's different here is that there's more than one neutrino going on now, rather than just being one neutrino. So rather than thinking of a neutrino being produced and then interacting and thinking of the cross-sections being separate, you have to worry about the interference of more than one particle making the same trip. And if their masses are not very different, then you know if one's on shell, the other one will be very close to being on shell. So that we have there's the exchange of these particles close to being on shell is dominating all the other graphs in the problem. So it's like the argument I gave over there, but where there's three possible things that could be on that line in between the two blobs. So it's a simple way to think about that is to think in terms of if you really did produce these things. And then you just evolve them in time. And then, so you produce, there's an amplitude for producing each of these three neutrinos. So I can think of this as being, it's the amplitude sum over I of the amplitude for producing the initial state goes to neutrino I. Neutrino I then propagates from you know, point A to point B. So I'll have e to the minus I. This happens at time t initial. And there's an e to the minus I, the energy of neutrino I, times t final minus t initial, which is that's the phase I get when I evolve a propagation eigenstate along. And then I got the amplitude for neutrino I to go to the final state at the final time. And so the only difference in these amplitudes, the only neutrino dependence in these amplitudes is basically these Vs. There's a whole bunch of kinematic factors to do with the electron mass, you know, but those are all fixed in this amplitude. So if I'm only interested in following what's happening with the neutrinos, I could follow the just the energy phase. So the amplitude for the whole process is then going to be some common factors which I don't care about. Let's say A naught times sum over I of E. So this is the amplitude of starting with lepton A and ending with lepton B. So we have VAI, VBI star, e to the minus I, energy I, let's say tau. Tau is the time. Nope, that's one up here. I don't want to write it. So the probability for LA, process involving LA and LB is going to be some factor of this thing squared times the square of this thing, right? So there's going to be sum over I and j of VAI VBI star VAI star VBI times E to the minus I VI minus EJ. And so when I is equal to j, there's something which doesn't depend on tau at all. But there's a tau dependence in the I not equal to j terms. And so let's do the simple case where there's two of these things. Let's say if there had been two neutrinos, and this would have been right hand side, so this sum is becomes in that case that the two cases where I is equal to j just become, you know, VKI squared VBI squared sum over I. That's one. And then you know, we have some I bigger than j. So we have, in that case, let's just start off with I unequal to j. I forgot j, sorry, this is a I sub j. Yeah, so this is going to be. Now, what I want to do is I want to approximate. So EI minus EJ times tau. So these are relativistic particles. So the energy, you know, is the square root of P squared plus M squared. And so for relativistic particles, that's approximately P plus M squared over 2P. So thinking that the thing that's differing between these two neutrinos is the mass, this is approximately MI squared minus MJ squared over twice the momentum times tau. And the tau is the time between these events. Typically what you measure is actually the distance, L here, between these events. So tau you should think of as being, you know, this is physics you learned on your mother's knee, right? V tau is L. So tau is L over V. But if these things are relativistic, then V is basically 1 because your mother used units for C was 1. So tau is basically L. If you didn't, then you're screwed up and there's nothing to do for you. So this is basically what's called delta M squared. It's not the difference of M squared, it's the difference of the squared masses times L. And P is E, the first approximation. So if we're thinking this as being small, we can just think of this being twice the energy of the things involved. So delta M squared. So if we have two neutrinos, this becomes two neutrinos. In that case, VAI, we could just write it as an orthogonal matrix. So it was cosine theta minus sine theta, cosine theta. So here we would have had what I'm writing here is so this would be E U, if you like, and neutrino 1 and neutrino 2. So here we would have so the probability for E going to mu, let's say, which is this, look at this case, would be E1 would have been cosine squared. So there's a divided by P0. It's cosine squared theta. B, so now B is mu, so this is mu 1 would be sine squared theta. And we do the same thing for the second neutrino. We've got sine squared cosine. It's just that now this is sine. If that was cos, that was sine. Now this is cos. This is, if that was cos, that was sine. Now this is sine, that's cos. So we have two of these. And here we've got, so AI is electron 1. So we have cosine beta. Then we have E1, so we have minus sine theta. Sine theta and cos theta. And if we done, that was when we chose 1 and 2. If we chose 2 and 1, we're going to get the same thing again. Except for the factor, we'll get, so we have to keep track of this now. So we have, here we have e to the minus I delta m squared l over 2e. In the case where we had I not equal j, we just basically had plus this. So when we add them together, we're going to get this plus this complex conjugate, which is twice the cosine. If I group this, this again, cos squared. There's a minus sign, there's a cos squared, there's a sine squared. And then you see that there's an overall factorization. We got 1 minus cosine. And if we remember our multiple angle formulas, that's, and I never do, so I have to think it through again. Yeah, so what is it? Sine 2x is 2 sine x cos x. That's not what I wanted cos 2x. That's cos squared x minus sine squared x, right? That's 1 minus 2 sine squared, or it's 2 cos squared minus 1. So we've got 1 minus cosine. So we want 1 minus cosine, that would be this one. So 2 sine squared x is 1 minus cosine of 2x. So what this is, so the 2 is very convenient. It goes away. So this 1 minus cosine is twice sine squared. So this is going to be 4 cos squared theta sine squared theta times sine squared. What was in this thing already, right? So that's delta m squared l over 4e. And this is just sine squared theta over 2, right? Or sine squared 2 theta? Yes, this is sine squared 2 theta. So that's a famous formula. And you can check that the probability of E going to E is divided by P naught is 1 minus this. So you see that, what's that tell you? It tells you that if this mixing angle is small, then there's various cases. If the mixing angle is small, that means it's almost a diagonal matrix. And this thing is going like the angle for small angles, it's going like the angle squared, which makes sense because the amplitude goes like the angle. It shows you that the, if you're interested, if you have a known energy of a neutrino and a delta m squared that you know, well, I guess the first thing should be that, so if you measure this thing to be happening, where E goes to mu, you can do that as a function of L, and you know what the energy is of the neutrinos. You can, by comparing what you get to this formula, you can fit for this angle, and you can fit for delta m squared. And so the experiments that see neutrino oscillations will quote for you what the mixing angle is and what the delta m squared is. And quoting it in terms of an angle and a delta m squared is appropriate when you have two neutrinos. When you have three neutrinos, you really have to use this thing and keep in mind that there's more than just one angle in the problem. You actually have a 3x3 matrix in the problem. But it's true that that the situation that's seen observationally is not far from two independent oscillations. So it's not badly described by, you know, because I told you there's atmospheric neutrinos see oscillations, and solar neutrinos see oscillations, and they see different oscillations. The delta m squared they see and the angles they see are different. And it's you can think of it to a good approximation as being two independent kinds of oscillations that are going on. The atmospheric one, it's the muon neutrinos are oscillating into tau neutrinos approximately because you're losing them. So that whereas you should have had twice as many muon neutrinos, electron neutrinos, you're just losing the muon neutrinos, and so then you're getting about equal amounts of both. Whereas in the solar neutrinos, what's happening is that you're oscillating away from electron neutrinos. So the electron neutrinos are turning into something else because the process there, you're seeing the absence of electron neutrinos in the Earth and an enhancement in the number of muon and tau neutrinos. And the numbers are such that for the atmospheric neutrinos, this is basically nu mu nu tau oscillations, approximately. This is an approximate statement where I'm thinking of it as being approximately two things that are going that are oscillating. Delta m squared is of the order of I used to have these numbers on top of my head. That's I'm getting old. Okay, 2 times 10 to the minus 3. Yeah. So something like 3 times 10 to the minus 3 micron volts squared. And the mixing angle is consistent with what's called maximal mixing. So it's like a 45-degree angle. For 45 degrees angle, if theta were pi by 4, 2 theta is pi by 2, so sine theta is 1. So this factor here is as large as it could be, basically. So sine squared 2 theta is approximately 1. For solar neutrinos, oscillations. Which you can think of as being nu E, nu mu and nu tau oscillations. The delta M squared is smaller. It's H times 10 to the minus 5. Sine squared 2 theta is large, but it's not 1. It's measurably different from 1. So it's, I guess the way we quoted here is sine theta is between 30 degrees. Theta is between 30 degrees and 38 degrees. Tan squared theta is between 0.4 and 0.5. Whereas if theta had been pi by 2, right, then sine would have been 1, cos would have been 0. So tan would have been infinite. So it's not, you know, if this is different from this, it's not the same kind of mixing angle. This is very different from what happened for quarks, remember. For quarks, quarks to a good approximation, all the thetas were small. It was really basically a diagonal matrix, a KM matrix, and then there's you're punished for leaving the diagonal. And here, the neutrinos are the leptons. One direction is oscillating like crazy, and this is not oscillating much less than crazy. So it's a very different pattern. What about resonant oscillations? This is all what's called vacuum oscillations. It's something which happens regardless of what's going on. But actually in the sun, when you're in a material, so the neutrinos are actually being produced deep inside the sun where the nuclear reactions happen, and they take about a second to get out. This radius of the sun is about 1 light second. It takes light hundreds of thousands of years to get out because it bounces around a lot. The neutrinos just go straight out. It takes about a second to do that. 8 minutes to get to the Earth. But when they're in the sun, you know, they interact with the things that are in the sun, mostly the electrons. So there's a, the weak interactions between neutrinos and electrons, have the form of, we could always write them, we could always Fritz rearrange them to be, G Fermi over root 2, 2 root 2 times E bar, gamma mu, gamma left electron, U bar, gamma mu, gamma left neutrino, I, J. Actually, I want to do this with the same. I, J. And then we have to have here, I guess, V, E, I, V, E, J star. So what I've done here is I've taken the effective theory where I've got, we had an electron, a neutrino, a W boson got exchanged, electron, a different neutrino, and I've taken the limit where the momentum is very small, the momentum transfer is very small compared to the mass of the W boson, so I can think of that as being, this propagator is just 1 over MW squared. This is approximately well described, you remember, by an interaction which is as if it was a 4 Fermi interaction with a coefficient which was coupling constant squared divided by MW squared, which is what G Fermi, that was what it was defined to be. G Fermi, you remember, was the SU2 coupling divided by 8 from W squared or something like that. The 8, I'm not sure about, but it's coming from this approximation that you're at low energies. At low energies corresponds to long distances. In position space, this W boson doesn't go very far. So it's the electron and the neutrino, they interact almost mainly next to each other. Because the W boson at low energies hasn't gone very far. Low energies, you haven't resolved things very much in distance. And so you can think of these two processes as being one process happening at one point, described by this effective Fermi interaction. It's a useful way to write it because if you're in an environment, if you're used to condensed matter physics or fluid mechanics or whatever your favorite condensed, more complicated than the vacuum system is. A useful expansion is a mean field expansion where you quantify your interaction with the background quantities by their average value plus fluctuations around the average value, and it's often true for large numbers of things that the fluctuations are small. So in the hydrodynamic limit. It's true that the electrons are not in the ground state anymore. They're in a complicated state described by some thermal bath of electrons interacting with a whole bunch of other crud. And so as far as the neutrino is concerned, it just sees the average of this interaction in that environment. So the effective neutrino interaction with electrons in the sun is given by G Fermi over 2 root 2, the average of E bar gamma mu in the solar environment times mu bar gamma mu gamma left mu I J times V. But this average we can do, because that's just the current which counts the electric charge or the lepton number of the electron. That's, you know, that's the vector part of this anyway. If it's a Faraday invariant environment, this this is E bar gamma mu, you know, 1 plus gamma 5 E over 2. The gamma 5 we can ignore, because in a Faraday invariant environment, a Faraday odd thing like an axial vector with a gamma 5 gives averages to 0. The only thing that will average to be non-zero will be the 1 term here. But E bar gamma mu E is just electric current of electrons. And so this is really a coupling to the current of electrons up to a numerical factor 2s here I'm not being very careful about. And the electric current for electrons in the rest frame of the sun is basically a charge density, and they're not moving much because they're moving slowly compared to the neutrinos. So that's approximately equal to, this is, I haven't, there's no electric, there's no factor of the electric charge, so this is actually better written as the density of electrons, delta mu zero. So this is, the mu equals zero term here is measuring the density of electrons. If I multiply this thing by electric charge, that would have been electric charge density. And then the space part is measuring the velocity of electrons when they're non-relativistic in the sun. So that's a small thing. So the first approximation, the only thing that contributes here is the time part of this, and it's proportional to the electron density. So you have effectively a coupling to G Fermi, electron density, numerical factors, which I'm getting wrong, times matrix elements V, E, I, V, E, J star, times nu bar, I, gamma zero, gamma left, nu j. So it's a density dependent, again, mass-like term. And so what we should really be doing when we're looking at propagation in the sun is we should be diagonalizing the masses, but we have to be more careful than we were before, because we have to diagonalize this term in addition to the mass term that we had. And so, so if you think of, the simplest way to think about this is just to think in terms of not the fields, but just think of the states. And we have a neutrino I, neutrino j states. As they evolve forward in time, they're evolved by some Hamiltonian. So this is the thing that evolves a neutrino state forward. And this Hamiltonian, if we kind of ignore momentum and we just follow the flavor dependence of it, the Hamiltonian effectively has a piece which is the kinetic energy, say E. So I want to follow the IJ-ness. I want to follow this as a 2x2 matrix in flavor space. So HIJ, or let me write it as, there's just a kinetic energy term which just doesn't care about flavor. There's a mass term. If I'm writing this in the flavor basis, there's a mass matrix which we've discussed, which is not diagonal necessarily. And then there's a, what I had over here was a coupling between neutrinos and electrons. And the main message here is that this is not the same for all electrons, for all neutrinos, sorry. No. So nu E interacts with electrons through the neutral current interaction, you know, nu E, Z, EE, but also through a charge current interaction, nu E electron W electron nu E. Whereas for nu mu and nu tau, we have this interaction, but we don't have this one. So this is nu E only. So the effects of the interactions with the neutral current interactions of neutrinos with electrons, I can stick into here somewhere. So there's some coefficient which I won't call energy anymore, but it's, let's call it, you know, A or H naught or something. It's something which I don't know what it is in detail, but I don't care as long as it's independent of flavor. I'm writing this in the basis of an electron and muon. So I'm using a flavor basis here. So that's why this is not diagonal, whereas the nu E only has an interaction here. So it's the interactions are conveniently written in the flavor basis. And we can always go to the mass basis once you're done. Right? Yeah, generation basis would be the same. I never use the word generation basis, but that's what that would be E mu tau basis, yeah. As opposed to the propagation basis. But now there's a matter term, which is basically, you know, for electron neutrinos, it's non-zero, so it's something involving the G Fermi of n, but then there's 0, 0, 0 for everything else. So the effective propagation, when we diagonalize things, we have to diagonalize both these terms. And there's going to be big effects when this is the same size, as when the difference between these masses is comparable to that, this is going to make a big difference, the fact that that's there. And for the diagonalization processes, this is actually relevant, because no matter what rotations we do, nothing happens here as long as we do unitary rotations. So, so when the differences in the mass squareds of the masses are of the order of G Fermi times Ne, this is a mass, this is 1 over mass squared, this is a mass cubed, it's a 1 over a volume, so it's like a mass cubed, so it dimensionally makes sense. When they're comparable, the presence of matter is important in finding the propagation eigenstates. So what you'll generally find is that the propagation eigenstates, and it happens that for the mass differences that we actually think are there, these are comparable somewhere between, you know, if this, the nuclear reactions happen deep inside the sun, basically right around here. This condition depends on the electron density, and the electron density is a falling function as you leave the sun. It starts off at a highest value in the center and then it falls all the way out. And this condition is satisfied. The point is that this is larger in the sun's center than this is, so that means at some point on the way out, they're equal. So there's a point here somewhere, which is where the resonance can happen. The resonance is when those things are comparable, so that there's a really a big change, a maximal change due to the presence of this extra term. So what happens is that if you plot qualitatively what happens, as a neutrino leaves the sun, it's seeing a time-dependent mass term, because this isn't changing, but this is actually changing as you leave the sun, because the density is falling as you leave the sun. So if you plot the effective mass, you know, the eigenfunctions of these things versus the position in the sun, what happens is that for the flavors of neutrinos that are not what I'm going to plot is these terms separately. If I look at the muon mass, the muon neutrino, it has a mass which basically doesn't care about where we are in the sun, because it doesn't actually take part in these charge current interactions. So there's one kind of term in the mass matrix just doesn't do anything. There's another kind of term involving the electron. If I take out if I remove the trace of this matrix, I can write this matrix. A 2x2 matrix can always be written as, you know, A minus A B B. And then basically putting a new term in here. And so this resonance is happening when A and B are equal, essentially. When A and B are equal, then the propagation eigenstate is going to be, you know, 1, 1. It's going to be maximally mixing these states. And what I'm plotting here are A and B. And so so one of them doesn't care much about where you are in the sun, because one of them is basically muon-like. It's not seeing these electron interactions. Whereas the other one is dropping as you see the sun dropping. The mass is falling as the density falls, and the density falls as the radius increases. Yeah, so dropping. So you start off here. So this is the one that starts off being electron-like. So this, if we had done the diagonalization here, we would have found a state that's very close to electron-like. So it takes part in the charge current interactions. It has a mass. It sees this term in the interaction with the electronic, with electrons in the sun. It's the one that's produced in nuclear reactions because it's most electron-like. So it's the what's we're typically getting produced. And there's another neutrino here which is not much like that one, which is muon neutrino-like. But as you leave the sun, what happens is that if you actually diagonalize this matrix properly, you know, I don't know if you remember this from quantum mechanics, but if you have, what we're doing here is degenerate perturbation theory, right? We have two levels that are very close in size to each other, and we're perturbing it with something else. And if you take a pair of energy levels and you adiabatically change them, in this case we're changing them as we leave the sun, if they ever cross, energy levels never cross, right? They always there's a property of in quantum mechanics which is called energy level repulsion. If you actually diagonalize this 2x2 matrix, what the eigenvalues really do adiabatically is they do this. That if you start off here and you adiabatically change the density, make this thing smaller and smaller, the thing that you'll come out with will be, you'll come out on this state here. And if you start off with this state and you adiabatically change this term by making it smaller and smaller, what happens is that you come out with a state that was originally the one that was most simply related to the electron neutrino. So the idea is that if the evolution of the neutrino out of the sun is adiabatic. So that's a question of how fast this energy, how fast this density profile falls as a function of the neutrino. So the neutrino is leaving at the speed of light, and you're comparing the speed with which it's oscillating with the speed with which the density is falling. If that's happening slowly, so that the density is falling very, very slowly, then you can think of this evolution in the adiabatic limit. And what happens is that the state you start off with here, which is most electron neutrino, it comes out and it just moves along the trajectory, and it comes out here, and it's completely converted to the thing that was almost mu, that was muon neutrino like. So in the adiabatic limit, it's complete, you know, nu e to nu mu conversion for any theta. You know, that didn't rely on this mixing angle being small. As long as there existed a point, if the mixing angle is zero, what happens is that this mass here will become down below this one, and so that there's never a point where, or this will start off being smaller than this, and so that there's never a point where, as this falls, they're equal to each other. So at some point, if theta is literally zero, then you don't have anything happening. But for basically independent of the size of theta, for small theta, as long as there's a resonance, you get 100% conversion of electron neutrinos to muon neutrinos in the adiabatic limit. If you go through the neutrino comes out really quickly, so if this profile, instead of falling slowly, if the electron density profile dropped like a rock, then what would happen is it would be the sudden limit in quantum mechanics. What happens is that you come down here and you just go straight through, and you don't see it happens so fast that you don't notice that there was a mixing with the other state. So the more adiabatic, or the more slowly the electron profile varies, the more efficient the process is, but it's a way which doesn't depend on the mixing angles very strongly. So in the vacuum, the whole oscillation vanished, was small if the angle was small. Inside a medium, it can be very efficient even though the angle is not small. And if you ask for the survival probability, so the probability of nu e goes to nu e as a function of energy, it does something like this. It starts off being 1. At low energies, it's 1. And then it goes down close to 0, where the size here is basically of order theta, so it's very, very small. Then it slowly climbs again at larger energies. And this is where the adiabatic condition is holding. Adiabatic. And so if you ask in this pattern, I told you originally that the neutrino spectrum from the sun, there were PP neutrinos that were something like this. There were boron neutrinos that were like this. And then there was another line that was here. This is the energy against number of neutrinos. The reason that the neutrino oscillations give such a good description of what they see experimentally is you're supposed to overlay the survival probability on this plot. And what you do is the fit just basically has it. So the survival probability is 1, then it drops like a rock, and then it slowly climbs again. And so you see basically 100% of those. You see essentially none of those. You see about half of those, so 50% of those. And that's a great description of what was actually being seen, that the experiments of water only see about a half suppression. The ones involving chlorine see about a third of what they're supposed to see, so they see more than half suppression. But then the ones that see the main PP cycle neutrinos that are the ones that are proportional to the energy flux from the sun, they see basically all neutrinos they're supposed to see. And that's exactly the pattern you'd expect from this kind of resonant oscillation. So it's not 15 minutes early, but that's where I'd stop, unless you have questions. So it's a very attractive picture, and it's being born right now. They're trying to measure this energy dependence, because that's actually a test that this is the right picture of what's going on. If you can measure the distortion of the spectrum due to that survival probability, then you're actually seeing that this is the right description of why the neutrinos are disappearing. Or if you can do an experiment on Earth where you see the neutrinos reappear, that's also evidence that you're seeing oscillations and not something else. But other ways of getting rid of neutrinos, like decaying, don't give you the right energy dependence. They don't do as good a description of what you see.